Akash Kapoor.
And I'm Amrit Sami.
And you're listening to What's the Problem? Amrit, you want to provide some context here?
For full disclosure, Simon Capital invested in Fintelity almost over a year ago. I'm still really excited by it because payments is a huge industry, and really there's a kind of growing trend within society to behave more socially responsible. And so kind of the Venn diagram of huge payments and social responsibility, I think, creates this really unique market that I think Fintelity are really focusing on. What about you?
I had the pleasure of meeting Shode just before this, and I think it was just interesting to see that there is maybe a focus on understanding the freelance space, a space that's clearly growing. And so, yeah, I was just really excited to hear more about what she's doing to tackle problems there. Without further ado, let's crack on.
On today's show, we have Shode Cosgrove, CEO of Fintelity. Fintelity is helping to revolutionize the social responsibility payment movement with a suite of products to help side hustlers, customers, and large organizations. Hi, Shode. Thanks for being on the show today.
Hi, Amrit. Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I guess, what's the problem you're trying to solve, and why are you so excited about tackling this problem?
Yeah, so the biggest problem we're trying to solve here is unaffordable debt. So we've built a suite of products which are looking at how we can prevent it from spiraling out of control, but also how we can correct some of those people that are already in a situation where their finances are keeping them up at night. And I think it's probably worth talking about from a practical level, the fact that if you are in a situation where you have a lot of debt and you physically cannot afford to make your minimum payments, how that can impact you from a financial well-being perspective, and the impact that it can have on like your mental health. So it can create stress and anxiety, and you can get stuck in that vicious circle where you can then continue to get into more debt to try and pay off the debt that you've already got, and before you know it, you're completely stuck. So that in a nutshell is what we're trying to address.
Yeah, and you've worked in the payment industry for a while, so why is there maybe a need particularly now that you're focusing on to behave more socially responsibly?
So myself and my business partners, yeah, we've worked together for like nearly 10 years across two different fintech organizations. So we've seen every kind of scenario that you can possibly think of across the ecosystem, from consumers through to merchants as well. And for us, it's something that we're very passionate about. We can see the gaps not being addressed, and there's the fact that there's a mismatch between credit and affordability. And that's something that we could see in our roles at previous companies, and something that we decided we want to tackle together. And that's kind of where the business really came to life.
I guess let's dig into that a bit further. Why is there a kind of a mismatch between credit and affordability?
So your credit score is looking at your history and your past behaviours, and affordability is more about the here and now, where you are in your finances in that exact moment. The two examples I like to use, because there's like two extreme ends of the spectrum. So the first example I use is the postgraduate, so university. So you come out of university, you're in debt up to your eyeballs, but actually you've got a good paying job, great salary, and you want to get on the housing market. That's the typical example, but your credit score is quite low, and that can hold you back from getting the best possible mortgage deal that you actually want. But you're in a good job and you're earning good money, and actually the terms should really reflect your current situation and your projected situation. So that's one example of somebody with a low credit score, but actually can afford more than what they're being offered. The other end of the spectrum, an example I use is kind of like a single parent. So a family, potentially like with the pandemic, might be a happily married couple at the beginning of the pandemic, but over 2-year period and all of the stress and everything that's gone on, becomes a single parent household. That person may have had a really high credit score before, and therefore if they went out to apply for potentially, you know, like a new car loan, might end up getting offered more money than they can actually afford to pay back, because their family income was actually reduced to one stream of money. Therefore that person may end up in a situation where they're taking on more debt than they can actually afford to pay back over a period of time. So as you can see with the two different examples and all of the ones in between, how this can impact different people. So ultimately we're coming at it from a place of protecting those that actually can't afford the products and services, but the ones that can afford it and aren't getting access, we're being inclusive by enabling that to happen.
It's interesting. It sort of reminds me of a conundrum of where it's people assume absence of evidence is evidence of absence, because they're kind of university students, right? It's just because they don't have the financial history, therefore their credit history is so low. but it's not kind of representative of kind of the here and now. How do you sort of see kind of open banking really helping to address that problem or make it better?
Open banking is great because it gives businesses like ours the opportunity to get direct access to the banking infrastructure so that we can, obviously, consent from the users, do transaction analysis so we can look at patterns, we can run our algorithms, and we can go through those transactions and work out, okay, what is the likelihood of this person being able to afford XYZ product in 6 months' time based on the current situation? But also that distinction of looking at disposable and discretionary income and salary as well. So it's removing a lot of the headache that some merchants are already dealing with from a paperwork perspective and looking at bank statements and payslips. So open banking enables all of that interaction in real time. So it's removing a lot of operational manual processes in that respect, but also it's real-time data. So we can see right here, right now, exactly what your current situation is and produce a relevant financial profile to the provider or lender that is considering whether to give you the particular product that you really want.
And if there aren't organizations like Fintelity improving financial inclusion on all fronts, how do you see this problem evolving over time?
Well, I think the problems are only going to get worse because we're in a cost of living crisis. And because of the pandemic, a lot of people's financial profiles have changed quite dramatically over the last 2 years and will continue to change as more pressures and stresses come in. So I think that from a merchant perspective, if you only focus on credit score, there's a whole bucket load of people out there who aren't going to get access to products that they really need if the credit score's holding them back. But at the same time, there's a whole bunch of people out there who you might be offering products to who then cost you more money in the long run through debt collectors because they can't afford to pay for those products. So I think we're in a situation where it's like we can't keep brushing everything under the carpet. We actually have to address it because things are actually sadly getting worse. Purely from a customer acquisition perspective, merchants right now need to open that net and look at every possible user case out there and how they can help if they want to succeed with the products that they're already providing. But also, yeah, I think the debt collection situation as well, so those people that are getting offered products that they actually probably can't afford, how much is that costing the merchant over time? So I think it's a situation where a lot of things can be prevented and we're literally at the beginning of that situation.
Wondering how much it's been on the merchant's radars. Are there quantifiable numbers that you know of, you know, a certain hit that they may have taken or like a certain demographic shift or anything where you can say they've just lost out in this entire market because they were using old-fashioned credit rules?
Well, I think the numbers that are probably highest are that the people that are being provided products that they actually probably shouldn't be and can't afford to pay it back. And the classic example there is the buy now, pay later industry, which has been not exactly regulated. They've kind of been let off the hook there, really. And, you know, the FCA, fair enough, are doing those checks and doing that overhaul of the industry and looking at, okay, exactly what should be in place for these merchants to operate. Because ultimately, I'd say, you know, millennial generation in particular, have been the biggest uptake of buy now, pay later. But also, we're now getting into where the fallout of that is starting to happen. So I think we're quite early on in knowing exactly what those debt collection numbers are going to be, but we're starting to see the fallout of it all. So I think, you know, in the next 12 to 18 months, there will be some really good data to see just how bad the problem is.
Sort of sounds like what's happened is our society has shifted and evolved so much that the existing financial frameworks to assess people are just insufficient, right? That it's either banks or consumers and people have a steady job, they get a mortgage, they have kids, etc. But now you've got the gig economy, you've got side hustlers, people are doing about 3 or 4 different jobs, and it seems like the financial underbelly just can't categorize those sorts of industries. And it seems like that's where a lot of part of the problem is that we can't categorize how we are as a society anymore.
Yeah, and I think, just to kind of lead on from that, really, specifically around like side hustle, because I think there's different things are motivating people to go down that path. And I think it stems back to, are you somebody who's being held back because of low score? Or are you somebody that's actually in a much better position than what's showing up on the system? Like with side hustles, what's great about that is you've got the people out there who are using them to bring in extra income to save up for some big ticket items like a wedding or deposit on a house to get on that housing ladder, which is a positive way to use a side hustle. If you can't get access to the credit that you need, or your income, your salary, your day job isn't bringing in enough money for you to have those things, or like a holiday. You know, how many people haven't been on holiday this year who would normally have had, you know, since the pandemic, obviously that was a different situation, but things are kind of almost normalish, can't afford it because of the cost of living crisis, but actually start up a side hustle just so that they can have the luxury of a holiday. But then you've got those people who are in debt and who can't afford their minimum payments, and actually a side hustle is a really good thing for them to do, because bringing in that extra income can help them tackle that debt faster, and then it opens up more options for them in the future in how they manage their finances.
I don't know if you saw Amrit smiling when you said save up for a wedding. He's dealing with planning one of those right now.
Yeah, I need a side hustle. If you've got any recommendations, do let me know. I'm taking on paper rounds at the moment.
Weddings aren't cheap. Well, they're as expensive as you want them to be. It's all about having an agreed budget up front.
What I'm saying is I wish I had this mentality app before I got engaged.
But yeah, it's a lot of good context on the problem, and definitely relate to just seeing the infrastructure issues there. But I guess moving on to the product and kind of how you actually are specifically addressing this problem, can you elaborate on kind of the suite that you offer?
Yeah, absolutely. So the best way to describe it is we're building an ecosystem, and that ecosystem enables people to get access to products and services they may not have previously been able to get access to. So we have built an API piece of technology that regulated merchants can use and plug into their application process for regulated products and services that you would need to apply for. So historically, if you need, they would have looked at credit scores, but they can look at affordability criteria and financial profiles, which is what we provide for our API. So there's that piece. And I guess that kind of ties into enabling access to people that are stuck, but also protecting those from ending up in unaffordable debt. But those people that are already in the circumstances where they have debt they can't afford, or they are struggling to manage their finances, then we have a consumer facing app that enables people to get automated budgeting, suggested budgeting to help them get back on the straight and narrow with financial education. And to take it the next step is that encouragement of, because we understand that there is a direct link between your finances and how you feel from a mental health perspective, and that piece around financial well-being is we're encouraging healthy hobbies that you can then monetize. So it makes you feel good from a well-being perspective, but it also brings extra cash for you to then reduce down that debt. And what we're doing that through is a QR payment. So if you have a side hustle, I don't know, whether perhaps you really enjoy going to the gym during the week, so on the weekend you want to do a little bit of personal training for like friends and family, and you don't want cash because you might be tempted to spend it on, I don't know, a takeaway or whatever at the weekend instead, you want to take that payment for your personal training services for your QR payment that can go into an account which you're using to tackle either saving up for your wedding or that holiday or for that debt that you really want to get rid of. So no matter where you are in your financial journey of either trying to get access to products or you're trying to deal with a mountain of debt, we can help you within our ecosystem.
Awesome. So hopefully it won't be just my mum listening to this podcast, and there'll be some potential customers wanting to hear about Fintelity. And so the question I want to ask you is, why should they pick Fintelity out of Onfido or all these other big names?
So from a merchant perspective, we have the ecosystem. So if they're using our API to onboard customers in the first instance, but those same customers are struggling with their finances, so they're using our app for them, what we're keen to do is promote positive reinforcement of those people that their profile is improving. So it's about then referring those customers back to that same merchant on better terms with discounts, etc. So I think it's about the merchant being more inclusive, but also working with those customers over a period of time and being able to offer them more products down the line as the two products kind of talk to each other.
Okay, awesome. And really what Fintelity does is it sounds like you're leveraging open banking, kind of build all these products, etc. And I guess for those who don't know what open banking is, could you just give a whistle-stop tour of it, how it starts open banking 1.0?
Quite simply, it kind of is what it says on the tin. So it is the banks providing open access to their infrastructure in a safe, secure manner. Everything's completely regulated. So in essence, with open banking, it enables businesses like Fintelity to get access to a suite of data and payments processing tools so that we can offer our products. So we would integrate directly into various different banks, and we can use that data to then do our affordability algorithm and also to facilitate payments. So the way it works is that the fintech in question has to have various different licenses in place, which we're then regulated by the FCA. So it's not just a case case of you set up a business and right, okay, I want to use open banking integrations. No, you have to follow a process. You need a license, you need to do testing, it needs to be signed off. But yeah, it's all about making financial, I guess, processing and data processing easier for third-party businesses, but also obviously the ultimate beneficiary is the end consumer. They're getting a better service, they're getting better products by fintechs like ourselves existing using open banking.
Yeah, and then I guess as you're growing and you're building up products, and you know, is there something particularly on the product roadmap that you're excited about that you'd want to talk about right now?
Yeah, I think the piece that we're doing around the side hustles, I think that really excites us because there's so many different areas that we can go into there. We're working with mental health organizations to signpost people within the app who are struggling while they're trying to deal with their finances. But I think there's a big piece around there for like coaching and for people who have got ideas and don't quite have the confidence to expand or to try that side hustle. So I think that's an area that we want to look into with the different partners that we're working with, and how we can facilitate that and really help some of those people that really take off with their side hustles and potentially it becomes their full-time job and perhaps they want to end up using our API eventually. That's the stuff that's really exciting, is giving those people that kind of like uplift to really get going.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. A couple of years ago, I did a lot of research on freelancers and the gig economy. I think the most interesting kind of demographic stat that I saw was, I think there's a massive growth in working women becoming freelancers. And there was, I think it was something like 1 in 7 projection was like for like a few years out was 1 in 7 women were going to be having like a significant chunk of income from like the gig economy. I'll have to dig up my old research to see what else was there. But I'm just curious, have you kind of seen any specific focus areas where you have seen growth in that? It's obviously growing in general, but is there a specific demographic that you've seen kind of growing there?
Yeah, students. Yeah. Funnily enough, I think that's really popular. Definitely students and working mums. So I have quite a lot of people in my network who love upcycling. So going around and, you know, purchasing furniture from kaboot sales and things like that, and then doing it up and selling it through Etsy or selling it at craft fairs. So there's craft fairs is a biggie, actually. But yes, and I guess like on social media, there are a lot of like get rich quick schemes, which people get burnt from, but they don't get completely, you know, downhearted from it. There's like, actually, no, there's got to be something out there that works. And I think that kind of the idea of you can be your own boss and you can make this money and then you can quit your day job, I think that's very much a really popular message on social media. So I think a lot of students buy into that. And I think the generation coming up, so the ones that are like in sixth form and A-level, who haven't even got to university yet, you know, how many of those, if they start their side hustles, would even need to go on to university because what they've done has taken off? So I think there are some future exciting numbers to look into, but I think that there's definitely a movement, I feel, that's going on right now.
Awesome. So I guess on that theme of setting up your own business, this is the first time you're a CEO, you've worked in previous payment startups in the past. The question I want to ask is, what has it been like setting up your own business? And I guess learning from your previous roles, what would you want to do differently and kind of incorporate at Fintelity?
Yeah, we're working at startups, so we're totally used to the whole kind of spinning multiple plates, wearing different hats. I think for us, really, and our biggest learning across the different businesses we've worked together at, is culture. I think culture makes or breaks product delivery, innovation, and sales. I think when you've got a team of people that can work together and feel comfortable to be honest about different things, whether somebody's going to be late or there's an issue or something outside of their control, I think that is really critical to the success of what you're trying to build and the customers that you're trying to serve. I've seen it in the past where people haven't necessarily felt like they can speak up or say what they really want to say, and then things kind of can spiral and there's the domino effect. So one thing that we are really keen to promote and to create within Fintelity is an open and honest culture of people who really get the mission and are passionate about it, but also ultimately have something to bring to the table and feel comfortable that they can share their ideas or raise concerns about ideas that have already been assessed. So for us, that's the most critical thing for us.
If you could ask a random VC or another investor one question, what would it be?
Okay. How do they assess female founders in comparison to male founders? A bit of a controversial one, but I think it's a well worth question.
Would you want to elaborate on why you want to ask that question?
Well, you see a lot of posts and blogs on LinkedIn about questioning techniques and different levels of KPIs and I guess expectations. So I think for me, just I would be intrigued to see if there is a difference or if it is just this is the bar, this is what I look for and this is how I approach things. So yeah, I think it's a topic that a lot of people are talking about at the moment. So I'm just intrigued to know more.
We're going to get one VC who's going to be really hot under the collar when we ask them that question. Final question. How can people find out about Fintality? How can they contact you?
So we are on all social media platforms and we have a website. So our website is www.fintality.com. Nice and easy. But like I say, we're all on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn and TikTok. We're constantly providing content and advice on how to budget and how to get through difficult situations, in particular with the current holiday season approaching. So if people need any money tips, then check us out on social media. But yeah, if you're interested in the products, you can hit us up on the website.
Brilliant. Well, Shadi, thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you. Pleasure. Brilliant.
I found it really interesting in the sense of a freelancer or a business owner who's starting out in their career of, you know, selling on the high street or selling a market or a Twitch streamer, and then being able to kind of convert that and helping them along the way of the journey to a full-fledged career, and where they can use Fintality's APIs to contract payments because they've got a t-shirt brand or, you know, have some items which they can sell. What about you?
I think what I really liked, it's similar thoughts, but it's one thing to want to solve a problem, but I think it's something else to really figure out where you can be a change agent. And I think what's really impressive here is that she's found certain segments where there's maybe a lack of business going on or maybe bad debt, and she's figuring out how to essentially capitalize on that to produce better outcomes through her product. So really enjoyed hearing your perspective there. But I did want to hear your follow-up take, Amrit, on the discussion around venture capital, and is there potentially a different criteria even for female founders as far as that goes? But I'd be curious, as the VC, to hear your thoughts, Amrit.
So yeah, I don't have a separate criteria to assessing female or underrepresented founders. I think the irony of VC situates is it's really innovative, it's really forward-thinking as an asset class, but it's still a very cottage industry. It's still growing and it's still really, really maturing. And so as a lot of legacy systems and thinking have been around since the 60s or 70s, I think there was a study in Harvard where it was the female founders more negative sort of questioning towards them. And I think once that skews the person's thinking, it creates a snowball effect. Unfortunately, female founders really get a fraction of the investment, even though they are perhaps good or if not even better than some of their male counterparts.
At the end of last year, there was a study that showed that about 2% of venture capital funding in Europe went to female founders. And I think if you look to exclusive female founders, it was even smaller. So yeah, I just think it was a totally fair question. I think at the point when you see numbers that small, there's clearly an issue with the criteria. There's clearly an issue there. I'm not sure what the solution is, but I think we definitely should be revisiting that criteria and seeing, A, are we asking the right questions? And B, are we asking everyone the right questions?
Awesome. Well, thank you guys for listening. Please like, share, and subscribe.